Hey, After Buzzers, before we move on to your next topic, we just want to say thanks to our sponsor, Anchor. If you haven't heard about Anchor, it's the easiest way to make a podcast. Let me explain. It's free. Plus, there are creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. Also, Anchor will distribute your podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and many more. Plus, you can make money from your podcast with no minimum listenership, and it's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. Download the free Anchor app or go to Anchor FM to get started.
After Buzzers, welcome to another Spotlight On. Today, we turn the camera on and the spotlight goes on to CBS Face the Truth host, CNN legal analyst, and author of best-selling book Make It Rain, Areva Martin, right now in studio. Stay tuned.
You're tuned in to AfterBuzz TV, the ESPN of TV talk. Now, let the buzz begin.
Who runs it?
Girls.
Who runs it? That's
girls,
that's right. That's right. Girls on the world. Welcome to Spotlight On here at AfterBuzz TV.
Oh, glad to be here, Mike.
My name is Michael Rippey. I am your host, and you can follow me on social media at Mike Rips, and I'm joined today by Areva Martin. That's right.
Yes.
And they can find you all over social media at Areva Martin. That's Instagram, Twitter, Facebook.
Yes. Everywhere.
ArevaMartin.com.
Yes, ArevaMartin.com. Mm-hmm. And on all social platforms.
And on all forms of broadcast TV, because you have a new show out, right? You're now one of the hosts, one of five hosts of the new show on CBS, Face the Truth.
Exciting. Yes, we just premiered on last Monday, September 10th. We started shooting. We shot a couple of shows in May, and then we came back in full force in August. So we are up and in full production now.
Yeah, and so we have got a lot to talk about. But if you want to see Areva on her new show, it's on CBS at various times, though. You can find all that out at facethetruthtv.com.
Yes.
Where they have your times depending on where you're located. You know, we have fans from all over the country and even internationally. Now, this show, you're one of five main female hosts. It's all women. Right.
Yes, I like to think of the show as kind of a cross between The View, you know, a panel show with five strong, independent women with, you know, very strong points of views, and then Dr. Phil, because the Dr. Phil piece is because it's a conflict show. So we're dealing with real people, real issues, people in conflict, and we're giving them solutions and we're giving them the hard truth.
So you are one of the five women. You probably know some of the other hosts. So you're on the show with Vivica A. Fox.
Yes.
Right. Dr. Judy Ho.
Yes.
Judge Scary Mary.
Yes.
Love that. And Rosie Mercado and you.
Yes. Five women, all from different backgrounds, all coming to this, you know, with our own lived experiences, helping people in crisis.
So how do we get to the point where we're going to have a CBS show with five very different, individuals coming together? Do you have a past with any of them? Are you familiar with them? Did you work in tandem? Like, hey, let's shoot this together. What do you think?
Well, that's a good question. So, again, I mentioned Dr. Phil because this show is produced by Stage 29. And Stage 29 is owned by Dr. Phil and his son, Jay McGraw. And they kind of run daytime TV, particularly when you think about the Dr. Phil show. I think it's in its 18th season. It's been the number one rated talk show for years, for decades. And then The Doctors is another Stage 29 production. And The Doctors is in its 11th year. And it's an Emmy award-winning talk show. And I was recurring as a co-host on The Doctors in seasons 9 and seasons 10. So I have a lot of history with Dr. Phil. I started on television in daytime working on The Dr. Phil show, being a legal expert, a commentator, an advocate for children and for women. And I was actually a part of another show that Stage 29 created some years ago called The Lawyers. That show didn't actually get picked up. So I've always had a great relationship with the production company. And when this show came to the producers, that, you know, I was one of the people that I'd like to say I was top of the list get the call.
obviously. So now you started the show. It premiered a couple weeks ago. You're shooting 2-3 times a week?
Yes, we shoot twice a week, 7 shows a week.
Wow.
Yeah.
And are you on every single show?
Yes. The five of us. Vivica Fox is the main host and the other four co-hosts. We're all on the show, all five of us, every show. every taping, every 6:30 a.m. on Thursday, 6:30 a.m. on Friday mornings.
And you have different segments, right? Because I looked through it all, you got categories, right? So there's like relationships, there's the dating, there's conflict. And
yes, there's mother-daughter conflict, there's husband-wife, girlfriend-boyfriend, you name it, we got it.
So when do you know when you're going to be, you know, mainly focusing on a certain specific category, or is it more free-flowing, you can just chime in when you want, or...
Yeah, the show, the concept is that all of us have, like I said, really strong voices, strong opinions. I'm a lawyer, as you know. I'm a civil rights attorney. Dr. Judy Ho is a clinical psychologist. Rosie is a life coach. And Judge Mary is a retired judge who actually sat on the bench. And then, you know, Vivica is a actress and producer. So all of us have all of these different points of views and experiences. So when a couple or guests are there, you know, we see something, we say something. So no, we don't have to wait. It's not scripted. Mm-hmm. We have a, you know, good idea about where we're going. You know, we're professionals. You know, this is a syndicated talk show. So we've got to deliver a product, but it's really us listening to the guests, you know, trying to understand what they're going through and then trying to offering them, the best advice we can. And what I love about the show is we're not just talking and giving them advice. They leave the show with solid resources. We've sent people to counseling. We've helped people get into rehab. We've sent people on, you know, 3-day exotic trips to spa vacations and, you know, things that really are going to help them improve the quality of their lives.
It's a good concept. It's got five females. You guys are running the world here in Los Angeles based on Face the Truth. You do so much more than Face the Truth, and we can come back to Face the Truth, but I wanted to just mention, obviously, you have a book out now. It's your third book, right?
My third book.
It's amazing.
Yeah. I call it my labor of love. It's called Make It Rain. I always tell people this story, and I tell them this to encourage them. So my first book, I self-published. It was called Journey to the Top. I just felt like I needed to share what I had learned as a lawyer working in a corporate law firm. So I wanted to talk to women who were in corporate environments, talk about, you know, shattering the glass ceiling, dealing with all the politics of a corporate environment. And then my second book is called The Everyday Advocate. I got a really big book advance and got a mainstream publisher, Penguin Books, to publish that book. And it was really based on my son, Marty, who was diagnosed with autism. I wanted to help families who were going through you know, the process of navigating systems of care and getting services. So I wrote The Everyday Advocate. And the book didn't do as well as, you know, the publisher thought it would do and I thought it would do. It wasn't really positioned in the right way. And I was told by my literary agent and a couple of publishers that I would never get another mainstream publishing deal again. And that if I wanted to write a book, I'd have to go back to self-publishing. And that's so not true. So anyone out there that's been told no to anything, don't believe it, don't accept it, don't receive it, don't internalize it. Just keep going, because I ended up getting a book deal with Hachette Book Groups. It's one of the five top publishers in the world, really. It's an international book publishing company. So that happened even after my second book didn't have the kind of sales that, you know, you traditionally see from a mainstream publisher.
Being told that you couldn't get another deal ever, did that push you even a little bit more to say, no, you know what, I'm going to be able to get this next deal? Well, was that motivation?
It was eventually. Initially, it was crushing. Mm. I mean, it was just crushing, like, really? Because I didn't have the best marketing team and, you know, we didn't sell a ton of books. You're telling me that for the rest of my life, I can never get a publishing deal? So at first I was kind of devastated. I was sad. I was kind of depressed. I was disappointed. But then something told me that can't be right. So I was like, you know what? That can't be right.
What was it that, because I'm sure there's people that are out there that watch you, that watch this. They say, wow, I mean, either I've been in that position or I've heard that. How did I get over that? What did you do to get over that initial sadness and feeling that you had?
Well, first, give yourself time to be sad, because whenever we get disappointing news about anything, you know, it's just a normal and natural reaction. So just give yourself time. Don't beat yourself up too much. So that's the first thing I would tell you to do. And then the second thing is, you know, pick yourself up after you get through with your little pity party. You know, you realize nobody's coming. There are no gifts. You know, it's just you and your little pity. You got to get back, you know, up and try. So what I did was I started asking around, like, how many copies of your book did you sell? And did you get another deal? And how did you do it? And what I started to hear from people was that was really bad information that had been given to me, and that there were lots of people who had written tons of books, many of which didn't do well, you know, their first one, two, three books. And then they went on to be bestsellers. So I just didn't let that one or two, you know, those two individuals who told me, a couple of individuals who told me I couldn't do it, I didn't let that be the way the story was going to be written. I did my own research, I did my own homework, and I just, you know, I discovered that there were other pathways. And I got a new agent. That was the first thing I needed to do, someone who believed in me. And I worked on building my platform so that my platform was stronger and bigger. So when I went to the publisher, yeah, I got this kind of book that didn't do too well, but look at all this other stuff I have going. So I think that made a big difference.
This is great, great advice, no matter what industry you're in, how you're dealing. I mean, some way to get over stuff that you can't beat yourself up. You got to, you know, you have your pity party, but then eventually no one is coming to save you. You got to do it yourself, the hard work.
Absolutely. And you have to believe in yourself, and then you got to find people around you. Your team is so, so important. So that last agent that I had who helped me get that second really big book deal, she lost faith in me because that book didn't do well. So she was like the last person I needed in my life because she was, you know, she was a non-believer. So when you're trying to do something big, you need people in your corner who are your cheerleaders who are going to, you know, not just the echo chamber that tell you something is good when it's really bad. You know, you need honest people, but you also need people that believe in your vision and your dream in the same way that you do.
Absolutely. That's great advice. Now, the title of the book, Make It Rain, it's about how to use the media to revolutionize your business and brand. And so you can get it anywhere. It's in stores, online, and it's got a nice foreword from Dr. Phil.
Yes, Dr. Phil wrote an amazing foreword. And the book, it hit the bestsellers list on Amazon in a bunch of categories. On the first day it was out, it hit a Barnes & Noble bestsellers list. And it's just done really well. I'm just amazed at the feedback that I get. I was really lucky. I got to do an amazing book tour. I've been to about 15 different cities around the country. I've been meeting with groups of women, business owners, brands, activists, advocates, just talking about how they find their voice and then how they use different forms of media to amplify their voices. So it's been really fun.
And I don't want to move forward too fast with you because I want to know, this is great news and congratulations, by the way, on your success with the book, but would there be a fourth book down the road?
Oh, I'm going to write a lot.
Okay, you just love writing?
Just to make that agent mad.
did you send the agent your book? Did you send a copy of the signed copy?
She has my book, yeah. I'm going to write a lot of books. I'm just on a mission to write books now.
Good. So. All right, well, you guys pick that up. You can get that on Amazon. It's in bookstores. You mentioned your son. And about the second book, and you mentioned how it was about basically your son being diagnosed with autism. And separate of that, though, you created a special needs network, right?
Yeah. So after my son was diagnosed, really difficult time for me and my husband and our family. I was really, like a lot of parents, kind of lost, didn't know what to do, didn't know where to find resources. But I realized that because I was a lawyer, I had a law firm, I had a lot of resources. I didn't have necessarily autism resources, but I had these other resources. So again, after that little quick pity party, after getting my son's diagnosis, I decided to do something about it. And I did a couple of things. I wrote a book called The Everyday Advocate, and I started the Special Needs Network, which is a 501c3 nonprofit based in Los Angeles to provide services, resources to families, mostly families in poor communities. I grew up in a poor community in St. Louis. So whenever I get a chance to help people that look like the people I grew up with, that's what I'm always about and trying to do. So this organization, over the last 11 years, we've raised millions and millions of dollars for autism. We've helped more than 50,000 families right here in the Los Angeles area. I got heavily involved in legislative advocacy. So I've been a part of some really big pieces of legislation, either helping to draft, helping to push forward in the California State Legislature. So it's really, you know, I have a lot of jobs, but the one I love the most, and I don't even consider it a job because it's really my passion, is working for the families that I have the privilege to work with through Special Needs Network.
It's really, really great to hear that, and it's obviously a cause very dear to you. What are some of the most recent events or activity that you've done with the network?
Well, we just finished our summer camp. We do a free summer camp every year. We have 300 kids.
Oh, wow.
And about 60% of the kids are kids who have special needs, either autism, cerebral palsy, or just a variety of different special needs. And then 40% are their typical peers. So we send these kids to this amazing day camp. They get access to, you know, friends. They get to build relationships. There's music, there's dance, there's sports, there's there's drama, and just a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. And it just creates this really positive, nurturing environment. And then we have this big gala coming up on October 20th. We are building the first ever integrated health and developmental center in the state of California, and we're raising money for that clinic. So we're always active in our community. We're not only just training parents, we have a big grant from the state of California where we're training other nonprofit organizations, teaching them how to become actively involved, how to do legislative advocacy, how to involve themselves in different civic engagement projects.
It's tremendous. Let's say someone is listening to us, they're watching right now, and maybe they have a friend, a family member, someone that they say, oh, this would be great for them. How do they find out more about this?
They can go to specialneedsnetwork.org. Okay. It's a website that has a tremendous amount of resources. Even if you're not in California, there are great articles and other kinds of resources listed on the website. And if you're in California, you can get involved with the network. You can come down, you can volunteer. And wherever you are, you can always donate money because nonprofits are able to do the work that we do because of the generosity of donors and sponsors. And you can go to Amazon and find my book, The Everyday Advocate. It's still in print there. And again, a lot of resources probably cost like $3 now. Amazon Amazing. Puts everything mm-hmm. on sale. So, but just again, a lot of resources for families who are either just getting a diagnosis or maybe they've had a diagnosis and they're stuck and they're trying to figure out what's the next step for their kid or their teenager or their adult. They may have a developmental disability.
It's tremendous work that you're doing. I'm really happy to hear that. Again, it's specialneedsnetwork.org to find yes. out information, get involved, donate. There's a lot of information there in case you're listening or watching. Let's talk a little bit about you. Okay. Reva Martin, right? I mean, you grew up in the Midwest.
Yes, St. Louis.
St. Louis.
Yes.
Midwest swing. So you grew up in St. Louis, and tell us your journey, because you end up as a Harvard Law graduate, which is amazing.
Yeah, I grew up, and I tell this story a lot. I grew up poor in a housing project with my grandmother and my godmother.
Not to interrupt, but do you know when you're growing up at that age, do you know that you're poor, or do you realize looking back on it?
You know it. Okay. Yeah, you know it. Okay. It doesn't mean that you don't feel loved or that you're not happy and having fun, but you know that there's something different about your existence because you're watching television.
Okay.
Hello. So you're watching, people in Hollywood, going swimming in their backyard or riding around in fancy cars or shopping or, eating out and having this like what appears to be perfect life. So you don't have to look far. You pick up a magazine, you pick up a book. So you do know it. And I went to an all-girls high school called Rosati Kane in St. Louis, and it was primarily a school in a white community. So if I didn't know it, by the time I got to that high school and met those very wealthy white kids, I definitely knew it then.
How'd you end up going to that school?
The hard work of my godmother. My godmother was a janitor. She cleaned offices. She cleaned houses. She was a maid. And she just worked to give me that kind of educational opportunity to pay my tuition so that I could go to this private high school.
So you go to this private high school, and is it at this point that you learn maybe I want to get into law?
No, at this point I'm a pretty bad student. No.
Well, this gives everyone hope. Listen to that, right?
There's a lot of hope.
Okay.
No, I was not a great... I think you're kind of angry when, you're a teenager. You're rebellious. You don't want to be at this school with these uniforms and all these rules and structure, and your friends go to the public school, and you have to get on this bus and go to this private school. So, no, I'm your typical kind of rebellious, angry teenager. And again, you said, did I know I was poor? Not a lot of role models in my community. So nobody had gone to college, doctors, lawyers, Indian chief kind of folks. So, I'm not getting a lot of positive reinforcement, even though grandma and godmother are working really hard to send me to this school. I don't think until maybe junior year, maybe even senior year, that I got really serious and realized that, I'm kind of smart. Maybe if I just open that book instead of just carrying it home.
What was the moment that made you realize it, though? Is there a seminal moment that said, I don't need to rebel, or I could rebel, but I'm smart?
Well, I always like to read. So my godmother, even though we lived in this really tiny little apartment, she had a lot of books. And one of her favorite books was Little Women. And she gave me that book. So I was always a reader, and I was always curious. I was that kid that asked a gazillion questions. And, parents with kids, like, can you really be quiet? No, I'm not going to answer that. Do it because I told you to do it. So they're not really engaging you in answering all these questions. But I was a kid that had a lot of questions, and I loved to read. And I think it finally dawned on me that subjects like history and English and literature that had a lot of reading, that if I just took some of that pleasure reading I was doing and read some of those school books, that I could do, you know, pretty well. So I think it was just making that connection between I did have this skill set. I didn't necessarily recognize it or know what it was. And I just, you know, I got serious and I applied, you know, it's time to apply to colleges, and I got waitlisted. So this is another students out there that are wanting to go to some really big, you know, Ivy League school or some top university. Don't get discouraged. I was waitlisted at the University of Chicago, and I was thinking, oh, you know, it's not going to happen. And near the end of the summer, you know, they're like, hey, we got a spot for you. So that's how I ended up at the University of Chicago. So, you know, I think for me, my life has always been about, you know, watching my grandmother and godmother make so much out of so little. I'm that resilient person. I'm that person that gets down, but I'm like down for like 3 seconds or something, or 30 seconds, 30 minutes, whatever. But I'm always like, okay, what's next? What's mm-hmm. next? So
It's great advice and wisdom to give to the younger audience, or even anyone out there that's down on their luck at you know, at any time that, you know, tough people make it through tough times.
Yeah, you have to, you know, and I always tell people, you know, your dreams work if you work, you know, they only work if you're going to work. And so that's one of the things I learned, was that I could outwork most of the people around me. So I had this just incredible, fierce work ethic.
And so the work ethic, you know, you're at University of Chicago, and that brings you eventually to go to Harvard. What point did you say it was? I'm still trying to figure out the point where you figure out law. I'm a legal expert. I don't just like to read books.
Not quite yet. So okay. I'm going to get you there. So okay. Get to the University of Chicago. I'm behind, because remember, I'm that, like, you know, kind of lazy student most of high school. So I'm at this super, super rigorous academic institution where everybody probably had graduated top of their class or top 3, top 5.
And be honest, when you get there now, because you said you were waitlisted, they let you in. When you got there and you're a freshman, did you feel like you had made it? And where?
Hell no. Okay. I hadn't made anything. I was intimidated. I was overwhelmed.
Were you still rebelling?
Do you like Nelly?
Of course.
Okay. So do you know how Nelly curls his R's?
Uh-huh.
Okay. So that's how, and I've totally remade my speech, but when you grow up in St. Louis, everybody talks like Nelly.
Mm-hmm.
I got to go, like, take some lessons.
St. Louis text.
Yeah, well, you know, it's your country talk. And so when I got there, people are, like, looking at me like, I can't understand you. I literally had someone now would be, like, shaming. We didn't call it then that, but she, this upperclassman, she really shamed me about the way that I spoke. And I stopped talking for almost 3 months.
Wow.
Like, I would not talk, like,
It stuck with you.
Yeah. And so I had to go remake my speech. I had to go change. I just had a show this morning I did on Dr. Phil about white privilege. So this is the white privilege people at the University of Chicago made me change my speech to be accepted. So there was nothing easy about that. It was a miserable freaking first year of feeling inadequate, feeling, you know, ill-prepared, and having to literally stop talking so that I could remake my speech so I could have a conversation with my white peers and be accepted.
So you're accepted.
there's some stuff for you.
At University of Chicago, what'd you study?
Economics.
Economics. You get an economics major from University of Chicago.
I have an undergraduate degree in economics.
And then you take that, and that's when we get
Okay, junior year at college. So now, you know, I've gone through, I stopped talking, I remake my speech. I'm 14 hours in that library. Now I'm killing it. There does come a time when I'm like, killing the academics. Like, I'm getting A's, A pluses. So that hard work is kicking in. I meet these guys, and these guys had all, they were juniors. They had all, you know, they were studying for the LSAT, taking the LSAT, and they were going to law school, and they all wanted to go to Harvard. And I'm thinking, you know what? I don't ever see them in the library. I know I'm smarter than them because I've talked to them. And if they're going to Harvard, why not? I've come this far. I've overcome all of this crap. I've, like, remade everything in my life. I'm just going to the top. So that's when I said I was going to Harvard.
So genuinely, it was because of these guys that you had met, and they were going, trying
to
go to Harvard.
Yeah, I get motivated by, like, I guess.
You're very competitive.
Very competitive. And people saying I can't do something. So nobody was, like, sitting at home, like, oh, you should go to Harvard. They're like, oh, my God, we're just glad you're in college, period.
Did you see the guys at Harvard?
Yeah, I saw them. Actually, one became a friend of mine, Justin. Two of them, Daryl Sharp and a guy named Justin Johnson. Two guys. They both got in. And at the time, there weren't many. The school had like a tiny fraction of African Americans. Maybe like 20 of us or something. Really small number. And so it was a big deal that these two black guys from the University of Chicago had gotten into Harvard. So you know, I was like, okay, you know what? I'm going to join these guys. I'm going to. And okay. I applied. I got into every top law school in the country.
But you decided on Harvard.
I decided on Harvard. Because by the time I get there, like, I'm, the confidence is there. But it took a long time. I mean, that's a long journey.
So you're studying law at Harvard. Yeah. Do you know the type of law you're interested in? Or how do you end up doing, kind of being the legal expert in deciding where? Because, I mean, law is so big and wide and vague. You can do so many different things.
You know, I was still, even though University of Chicago, Harvard, at heart, I was still that girl from St. Louis who, you know, just knew what it was like to have to overcome a lot of obstacles, who knew what it was like to have to work hard to earn everything that I got. And so I knew I needed to figure out a way to use my law degree, you know, and to merge it with what my passions were, my passions for helping people. I didn't do that immediately. The first thing I did is I got out and got a really high-paying corporate law job. And it was so funny because all my friends, we all got these really high-paying jobs. What would be the equivalent now, because I was just looking at this in, some law journal, it would be like making first-year law students coming out of top law schools now make about $180,000, $90,000. Fresh out. Haven't done a thing. Like, can't even find a courthouse.
Well, they got a degree from Harvard Law.
$180,000. So that would be the equivalent of what I was making. So I thought I was, like, rich. I thought I'd die, gone to heaven. But my Midwestern values, all my friends were buying big expensive cars and moving to the marina and to the beach. I moved into this tiny little apartment downtown by MacArthur Park and bought this 10-year-old Jetta.
Okay.
So that was a good smart on my part because it allowed me the freedom to quit that big paying job. So when I was ready to go, I was like, you know what? Enough. I didn't have all, you know, like all super overhead.
Did you do that because you're an economics major? You understood money?
I understood money, and I understood that I wasn't going to probably make that money always, and it was more money than I had ever dreamed of making in my life. So I was like holding on to it. I was like saving my money. Everybody else was buying like Mercedes and Porsche. I was like, nope.
It's interesting you say that though too, because you, they, I mean, you, there's two type of people too. Someone that hasn't had any money maybe comes into it and then they say, they just want to buy everything. Yeah. Or there's another person that, you know, you get that money and now you say, how can I make sure I never lose this money and keep making more and be cognizant of that? And it sounds like,
no, you're right. And a lot of people do. And
I mean, you hear stories of like athletes. That they get that big paycheck.
Or lottery winners, right? People win the lottery and they go crazy and they're broke.
They're bankrupt.
5 years later, that happens a lot.
Frequently.
No, I think for me, again, I don't know. I just blame, you know, I credit it to my Midwestern values. I didn't need a whole lot. I was already coming, like, to the city where palm trees and, you know, ocean and beaches. So just being in L.A., basis being in St. Louis was already like a lottery to me.
So you ended up in LA after Harvard Law?
Yeah, I came out here to take a job. Yeah, I came to take a job.
Were you applying to jobs all over the country, or did you specifically say, you know what, I want to be in Los Angeles?
Okay, because you messing with my feminist raps. I got to tell you about a man now, see?
I see. All right, now we know. See, I got to get down to the real nitty gritty here. We know
why.
You're
going with my feminist story. Yeah. But no, I met my soon to be future current husband in law school. And he was
hopefully from, forever, not just current. Yeah.
Current.
The current husband.
Ever, ever, ever to be husband. So he was moving back to L.A. because he was from L.A. originally. And I said, you know what? This is what I'll do. I'll come out for a summer job. And if I like it, you know, I'll consider it.
If you like it.
Oh, my God. I fell in love with
it. Well, after spending winters in Chicago and then in Boston.
Yeah, I mean, just the weather, the, you know, the lush green, you know, trees and lawns. So it was a pretty simple decision.
So you're doing corporate law, you're a lawyer, but how do you make the transition, or not just the transition, but end up where not just are you a lawyer or doing legal expert work, but now you connect with Dr. Phil and you're going to say, you know, I'm going to combine not just being, you know, expert in the law field, but also with, you know, hosting or television panelist type of role.
Yeah, no, that's it's a big jump. I talk about it a lot in my book, Make It Rain. But what happened was, after I left that corporate job, I started my own law firm. So I started doing trials. I was a basic trial lawyer. I shouldn't call it basic because trial lawyers work really hard. But I was a trial lawyer. And I started, my practice was focused a lot on civil rights. So I was representing people involved in discrimination lawsuits, whether it was race, gender, religion. And working 14, 16-hour days, going to court all day, coming back to the office, working, managing staff. And I was representing these families in Las Vegas. They had kids who had been abused in the classroom. They were some nonverbal autistic kids. And the story got a lot of national news attention. And the Dr. Phil team saw the story and they invited my clients on to talk about their experiences and what it was like to have their kids abused. And they wanted some help from Dr. Phil, like, how do we get over this? Because they were traumatized. And I came on the show and the show went really well. And some of the producers came up to me after the show and said, hey, Areva, we're doing a show on Dog the Bounty Hunter and his use of the N-word. And we have this all-male panel. And we need a female voice. Will you stick around for B-Show and be that female voice? I was like, why not? Sure. And I didn't know the story. I hadn't read anything about it. And they come in and they give me this big stack of news articles all about, you know, Dog and this daughter. And you remember, I don't know, this big story about should a show be canceled because of him using this word. So again, that show went really well. The producer's like, hey, you know, if you have other stories you want to bring on the show, call us. And if we need a strong female voice on some of our stories, we're going to call you. And that was how that relationship started.
And obviously you must have enjoyed it.
I enjoyed it. And I realized, one, after the show aired, I got so many calls. I started getting calls from people all over the country who had cases similar to the family that I was on TV with. You know, other people who wanted to tell me their stories. And something occurred to me. It says, wow, Areva, you know, I can represent a family in a discrimination case in court and win for that family and help make that family whole. I can recover millions of dollars for them. But there was nothing like that appearance and being able to literally, in a one-hour television show, reach millions of people. And that's what got me interested in working on television. And I stayed working with the Dr. Phil team for a couple of years. Then I got heavily into cable news. So that's where I really got my commentary chops, was going over to work on HLN.
Yep.
I worked a lot on MSNBC, a little on Fox, and then ended up as a CNN.
I want to get there in just a second. I want to ask you one question. So your law firm, it's Martin & Martin LLP, right?
Yes, in Los Angeles.
You're identified as a Southern California super lawyer for the last 3 years, right? A designation that's reserved for the top 5% of attorneys in the state. And me, I want to know, how do they determine what the top 5% of attorneys would be?
You know, they have this process and people have to nominate you. So you get nominated to be identified as a super lawyer. And they, you know, they have this kind of internal vetting process. And only so many lawyers every year get that designation as a Southern California super lawyer.
Okay. Just one of those things I'm wondering. What do they determine 5%? But so you're a super lawyer.
Yeah.
Not just a lawyer, a super lawyer.
Superhero.
Yeah, you're a superhero.
I don't feel so super most days, but that's I like the designation.
Well, so you're regularly on CNN at this point. Good Morning America, World News Tonight. Obviously, now we have Face the Truth. You know, you started doing cable, you know, appearances out here in LA. You just talked about it, MSNBC. What has it all been like, the culmination of starting, you know, in law school to then having a law firm to now being a legal expert that's not only on a talk show about it, but you're providing legal advice to not just individuals, but people around the world, and your opinion essentially on current political and pop culture and just newsworthy events.
Yeah, Mike, I have to tell you that I consider it an honor and a privilege, because you're right. I get to opine. I get to, you know, voice my opinion on some of the most pressing and important issues, not just legal issues, but, you know, culture issues and, you know, issues on race and politics. And I take that very seriously. If you think back to pre-2016, before Donald Trump was elected, probably for 2 years, there was just a barrage of stories on cable television about African-American men, unarmed men, being shot by police. And I spent a ton of time, almost daily, on television talking about those stories. And I would have people reaching out to me, you know, giving me their perspective, some hate-filled, you know, Twitter messages, but mostly people saying, wow, I'm just so proud. I'm so glad that you're there. You know, thank you for speaking up. Thank you for representing, you know, us and you know, sharing this perspective. So that made me realize that my job as a commentator, that I'm not just speaking for me, that I get to speak for the voiceless, or people who would never get to, you know, sit and have a conversation with Anderson Cooper or Don Lemon or, you know, one of the hosts on some of these cable networks that, you know, millions of people turn to get their news, to figure out what's going on in the world. They rely on the voices on these stations. And so I take it very seriously. I spend hours preparing sometimes for a 3-minute segment. I may read 5 hours of material because I want to be accurate. you know, I want to be a trusted voice. I want to be someone that people can rely on. And I recognize now that people, you know, they turn to me, they go to my social media pages, they go to my website, and they want to know what I think about issues. And that's, you know, that's overwhelming. And with that kind of privilege comes a lot of responsibility.
So as a commentator that appears on many major networks, do you have, give the viewers and even myself and everybody listening an idea of how that works as far as, will you go on every network? Will you go on anyone that asks you, or will you say, no, I won't go on this, and why, and how do you decide?
Yeah, so typically when someone starts out, I'll just talk about my own path. When I started out, I was widely seen on a lot of different networks. And then I went from being a guest commentator to now I am a paid contributor for CNN. So once you get a contract with a network, that oftentimes will limit the other networks that you can be on, you know, like competitors.
Makes sense.
You have these exclusivity clauses. So you're not going to see me on MSNBC. You're not going to see me on Fox. I still have my relationship with GMA, ABC, and some of those shows. You'll see me on Dr. Phil. You'll see me on Daily Mail, which is a new platform. So you'll see me on you know, a variety of different shows, but you won't see me on like CNN competitor shows.
Okay, but on CNN, will we see you on only one specific show, or will we see you kind of across the network at night, depending on,
you'll,
you know,
see me across both networks, CNN and the sister station, mm-hmm. HLN. Mm-hmm. So it's not typically set like on Monday, you're going to be on, you know, the news at 10 a.m. Typically, it's driven by, because these are news driven shows, they're driven by breaking news of the day. I can pretty much guess if the topic is Me Too, you're going to see me a lot on CNN. I've been a really strong voice on the issues of sexual harassment. If the issue is race, if the issue is, you know, police brutality, you're probably going to see me a lot. Now with Judge Kavanaugh and his whole confirmation, now that we've had Dr. Ford come forward and talk about, you know, her allegation of attempted rape, I've been on this week. I'll be on some more this week talking about that.
I was going to say, you're stealing my thunder, because that's actually what I was just looking to bring. I wanted to, I mean, because we have a commentator, and I want to at least go just looking at your Twitter. One of your most recent posts, you talked about what's in the news now, which is the Supreme Court justice or a potential justice and his nomination, and the news of Dr. Ford, a research psychologist from Northern California, accusing him of sexually assaulting her over 30 years ago at a party. And obviously it's, you know, a huge drama and politically. So you wrote recently on Twitter, stand your ground, Christine Blasey Ford. Your request for an FBI investigation is reasonable, and the only way allegations of attempted rape should be handled. Any other way to make mockery of the process and your right not to be bullied and humiliated. And you say that Brett Kavanaugh, the potential Supreme Court nominee, should withdraw. Now, is this the type of pundancy or information that you'll provide on Twitter in general on all sorts of things? I mean, you just say it the way you feel it.
I say it the way I feel it, but it's informed.
Yeah.
So
sure.
When I say that an FBI investigation is the way to handle this, that's based on, you know, what I know and my years of experience as a lawyer. So I'm not just, you know, pulling that out of thin air.
Yep.
I know from my experience that to investigate claims of attempted rape, you need experienced professionals that know the science, that know the psychology of victims, and that know how to elicit information from both the victim and the alleged perpetrator and possible percipient witnesses. So when I say the FBI investigation is a reasonable request on her part, again, that's based on what I know from a legal standpoint, my expert opinion on how these kinds of allegations should be investigated.
Do you think it will be investigated?
I don't think it will be, but I think the fact that she's come forward, which I have to give her so much credit for, it takes so much courage for women. And even in this Me Too era, this movement, women are still doubted. You know, there's a phrase someone coined, slutty and nutty. So when they come forward, they're slut-shamed, or they're, you know, accused of being confused, mistaken, you know, not all there. You know, maybe they have some emotional problems. So even in this era, it's still so difficult. And I can remember a time, I've litigated a lot of these cases as a civil rights attorney, when women were absolutely petrified to tell their stories because they knew the repercussions that they would face. They were often fired. They were often shamed by colleagues as well as family and friends. They were ostracized, and oftentimes it meant, you know, career suicide, particularly depending on who you accused. If you accused a powerful, you know, boss, a CEO, or industry leader, it could mean the end of your career. So it's just amazing to me. So whether the FBI investigation takes place or not, we are now having a very serious conversation about someone who's seeking to have an appointment to the highest court in this nation.
It's a lifetime appointment as well. Lifetime so appointment. Extremely important. Now, what would you say to the person that says, well, because I did a little research on this, and it sounds like that Dr. Christine Blakely Ford, she provided Senator Dianne Feinstein the information in July. I guess she didn't want it to come out. What do you say to the person that says, well, the Democrats or Dianne Feinstein had this information in July and they're only providing it out to, you know, the public now? Because I hear that often as a retort on, you know.
And I'll say that's right out of the playbook of, I'll call, the 1980s and 90s. When people, again, are trying to dictate to the victim how she tells her story, that's her story. Mm-hmm. And if she didn't want to come forward, that's her right not to come forward. It was her right to contact Dianne Feinstein and to ask the senator not to release the information. And look what has happened since the information has come out. Every nightmare, her worst nightmare about coming forward has come true. She's had to move out of her home. She's had to erase all of her social media sites. She's gotten death threats. She's been, you know, attacked in the most vile way possible. She had Senator Orrin Hatch go on television and say she's mixed up and he's never met her. He's never talked to her. He's never read an investigation. He had absolutely no basis for making that statement. So the reason she didn't want to come forward, all of the reasons have been borne out by what we've witnessed just over the last, 72 hours?
Okay, so I want to move away from this situation with the your legal expertise in that and move towards the Me Too movement, because we don't have that much time left, and okay. I want to talk to you about it, because I know it's very paramount in your life and what you stand for and stuff. How do you feel like it's been, obviously, it's so mainstream now within what's going on, and we find out new things regularly now all the time. How do you feel like it is going? For females and for women, and how do you feel like the movement may be in a lull right now, you know, from being in the news, top of the news? How's it going, and where does it go from here?
Well, I think we've made some progress because we're talking about it. We can't fix what we don't acknowledge. So just by acknowledging that post Anita Hill, 27 years after those hearings aired on national television, we realized that sexual assault is still sexual harassment. There's still issues. Some people say we're still in a rape culture. Rape culture being a culture that where women's bodies aren't respected. And when women tell their stories, they are disbelieved. They're discredited. So I think we've made some progress. Again, I think back to when I was litigating these cases as a newer lawyer, a lawyer just barred. I see differences. I see women willing to come out and speak out. And I see men, you know, willing to say that this culture should change, that men's behavior must change. But are we where we need to be? Are women safe in the workplace? Do I think my daughters who are entering the workforce are going to be in a gender neutral environment where they don't have to worry about sexual harassment or sexual assault? No. I think we still have so much work to do. And this nomination and this allegation made against the nominee, I think just shed so much light on how hard it is for people to even understand. And in addition to people saying, why did Feinstein take so long? Why did Dr. Ford take so long? That's a retort we're hearing over and over again. And again, a lack of recognition about how painful and how difficult it is for someone, and mostly female, because that's what the statistics tell us, how hard it is for them to share these stories. So I applaud the women that have led the Me Too movement. I actually, Tawana Burke, who coined the phrase initially before Rose McGowan, she and I sat on a panel together earlier this summer in Chicago and talked about, you know, what it took for her to come forward and some of the progress and the lack of progress that we've seen since the movement has started.
Okay, so you would say that there's a lack of progress meeting kind of the progress.
I say we're having the conversation, but we have work to do.
Work to do. I mean, well, I would say on one hand, there's always work to do in everything, and for sure in this situation. But it does seem like that these stories are getting a little bit more traction and a little bit more. You can't just brush it under the rug, and that there are more women. It seems like lending their voice to what's going on, and also even running for, it seems like, for political office. It seems like women are getting more involved in that part of I guess the Me Too movement.
Oh, absolutely. But it's important to note, this is not a women's movement. This is a people's movement. Mm-hmm. And we can't change the culture because, for the most part, we are not in the power in organizations as women to change these structures. So we need men who sit at the seat of, you know, at the head of these tables and who are in the positions of power in corporations and government in all of our institutions. We need them as allies. We need them being, you know, upstanders and not bystanders. So when we see something like Senator Orrin Hatch, that just reinforces, you know, that kind of 30-year-old thinking about women when they come forward. Who gets sexually assaulted, tells it to their therapist, tells it to their husband, and yet they're mistaken about it? I mean, what's the logic in that? There's just absolutely no logic. And even people who said she's a Democratic operative. So 2006, even before Kavanaugh was nominated or thought about, Donald Trump's not even in office. This woman is sitting in a therapist's office in Palo Alto, California, creating out of thin air. And then guess what? She puts the guy's best friend in the room with her. Who does that? I mean, just think about the logic of that. I'm going to make up a story and I'm going to put your best friend in the room as the witness. That's just nonsensical.
That's a good point. We have a little bit of time, and I want to turn it back to maybe a little more positive vibes.
Okay.
all for the Me Too movement. Hopefully it continues to grow, and with advocates like yourself, I'm sure, you know, powerful voices, it will continue to change the culture of America, ideally. You are very into fashion.
Yes.
And running.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I love clothes. I've always loved fashion. And actually, one of the events we do for the nonprofit is called the Pink Pump Affair. We do it every May. We honor outstanding women, and we do this amazing fashion show. And this year in May, we did it at the Beverly Hills Hotel. And Kevin Hall, who's a designer whose dresses are always on red carpets with celebrities, he was our fashion designer. So we celebrated 10 years of this event and 10 years of having this pretty amazing fashion show, just highlighting women and, you know, women. And that's what I love about the Me Too movement. It's a way of saying, you know, you don't have to dress like a man. You don't have to, you know, try to take on masculine traits. Women can be powerful in pink.
So,
and that's what the Pink Pump event
is about.
What's
your fashion advice? Do you have some?
Ooh, wear what you want. I you know, you no rules. I grew up in the Midwest. You couldn't even wear white after Labor Day. So you know how happy I am to be in LA?
Is that a real thing?
That's a real rule. You couldn't wear patent leather after Labor Day, and you couldn't wear white.
So, I don't know the rule.
I remember a friend coming to visit me who grew up in Cleveland, and we were best friends in college, and I'm taking her shopping. I'm trying to get her to buy these patent leather shoes. And she's like, I can't wear that in Ohio. You're in California. I'm like, no, break the rules. Break the rules. So my biggest fashion advice is break the rules.
There you go. I mean, you might be getting calls about coming on to fashion shows next. Running. You are an avid 5K and 10K runner, yeah?
Yeah, I have a running partner who's a marathoner. Her goal was to run a marathon on every continent, and I think she's just about accomplished it. Maybe she has two more to go. She's done all the majors: Boston, New York, San Francisco, Chicago, LA. I haven't done any marathons. I've done three halves, but I like the shorter runs. I love just running. Great way to clear your head. And I hate that running and exercise gets associated always with weight loss. And I'm always telling folks, you know, exercise is not just for people who have a weight problem. There's so many other benefits to it. I wish it could get a better rap so that people could, you know, realize all of the wonderful things that exercise does for you, like all the endorphins that you
feel. Releases in your brain.
Oh my God. And I do some of my best thinking when I'm on my runs. I come up with all kinds of ideas. I'm like, oh, that's a good idea.
What's the distance in an average run?
I run now probably 3 to 5 miles.
And how frequently?
4 days a week.
4 days a week?
Yeah.
Wow. 4 days a week.
Yeah.
Have you ever run a marathon?
I've not. I've done three halves.
Three halves. Do you want to do a full one?
No.
Why not?
The training. So, okay, here's the thing. My marathon partner, the marathoner, I mean, that's been her life. And a lot of people, you know, it's like kind of like their bucket list. It's just not for, I just love running and I feel like my life is so busy and so full. I'm not going to take on another big training. Like, so I'd have to train too hard.
When you were training for like your half marathon and you're running, you're training with your marathon partner, did you, you know, you're training, you run your half and then she's like, oh, I got another half to go. And she runs off.
We would get into big fights because we would go out and we're supposed to run like 8 or 9 miles. And then I'd look up and it's like 11 freaking miles. And I'm like dead tired, ready to fall out. And we run in a hilly part of LA County, like in the View Park and Baldwin Hills.
Then.
And I'm like, okay, I need a way back to our car that doesn't have a hill. And so we always laugh about how, like, one day I had a big meltdown because I was at mile 11 and I just couldn't take it anymore. And marathoner, see, she doesn't quit. We were out one time running in the rain. I'm like, okay, can we just stop and get Uber and go home? And she's like, oh, no, we're tough. We're tough. I'm like,
surprised.
No, I'm not. I'm a wimp.
You said you were at the start of this interview and conversation, you were ultra competitive. Now we found the place where someone can compete with you and beat you.
Yeah. See, I know my limits. See, okay, that's a good thing about a competitor. You know your limits. So I'm not going to outrun this woman who's a marathoner. And she's like she's like a gladiator. She's crazy, but she's in her body. We went to the Korean spa and she, you know, you have to take all your clothes off at the Korean spa. Okay. And I was like, okay. I was body shamed just looking at her because her body is like, oh my God. So
what's the next 5K or 10K that you're running?
I don't have anything on my schedule since we started shooting the show.
Busy.
I'm giving myself time to, you know, get comfortable, ease in. So even a lot of my traveling for my book, I've kind of, you know, had to rein in because you got to be fresh. You got to be, you know, sharp. You've got to be ready when you're, you know, taping 3-4 shows a day and working with such smart women. So you got to bring your A game. So I'm giving myself room and space to, you know, be at my best.
I like what you did there. A shout out to the women of Face the Truth.
Last
question. We'll get you out of here. And that is, you've got a blank canvas. What's your ideal role as a commentator or a show? Are you on it right now? Or what's left for you?
Oh, wow. That's a big question. I'm going to just say that I am living my best life right now.
It's important.
Yeah, I'm doing, I think all of our lists are long. And if I went through my lists, I'd have a lot of check marks by things that I had set as goals. There's always more, you know, super ambitious, super competitive people. There's always more. But I'm pretty damn happy right now.
That's what we like to hear. Areva Martin. You can find out all about anything you didn't hear. You want to learn more about her at arevamartin.com. You can follow her on social media at Areva Martin. That's on Instagram. That's on Twitter, Facebook. See her on CBS, Face the Truth TV. It's
daily.
Syndicated daily.
Daily.
They got
every
5
day.
Strong women. She's one
yes,
of them.
Every day.
We started this show with All About Women, and we'll go out with All About Women. So thank you for joining
us.
Thank
you, Michael.
Come back again when you have another book, another story to tell.
Absolutely.
Thanks so much, guys, for watching us on Spotlight On. This is the series where we introduce you to new and exciting people. Thanks so much. We'll see you next time.
Our founder, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and me, Maria Menounos, would like to thank you for tuning in to AfterBuzz TV. Remember, we're not just the first, we're the biggest in the world, and we're the only destination for all your favorite TV shows. Whatever you crave, we've got it. So go to AfterBuzzTV.com and check out our lineup. Buzz you later.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of AfterBuzz TV or its owners or principals.